511 or RayatRT.ie. Now, I'm looking forward to our next guest. She rose to fame when her book, The Tattooist of Auschwitz, became an international bestseller. Her name is Heather Morris. She has a new book out called The Wish, and she joins in the studio. Good afternoon, Heather.
Good afternoon.
Yeah, thanks so much for coming in, and congratulations on The Wish.
Thank you.
So this is off-brand, as you're saying, this
book. It's off-brand.
Explain that to our listeners.
Okay, well, when you write a story and it does become successful and it's classified as historical fiction, well, the word goes out, do another.
Yes.
So you do another, do another, you do another, you do another.
Yes.
And then it's, well, can I actually try telling a different story, a story that's been dear to my heart for over 20 years? Initial reaction was, nope. I said, read it. So they read the screenplay that I wrote of this over 20 years ago and I got the nod.
Uh-huh. It must have been a bit scary for you if you have a brand and a successful brand, and you have fans, and now to do something different. How was that in your head?
That's why I'm here. I'm here trying to convince all you wonderful people here, and not just Dublin, but in Ireland, that give this one a go.
Yeah. And it is from the heart, and you say it was written as a screenplay over 20 years ago, and it is based on your former life, which was what?
I worked in the social work department of a large public hospital. Cradle to the grave, we called it, the hospital. Babies were born there and elderly people died there and everything in between. And over those 20 years, I've sort of passed through and worked in many areas of the hospital. But those 21, 22 years ago, I was connected with the paediatric oncology ward. And something played out there with one particular patient and a young man who came into the hospital just to deliver a game to a patient. And how that introduction then changed his life.
Right.
Not the patient's necessarily.
Yes.
But his. And I wrote it.
So you use that as your spine. And then I'd imagine the other characters are an amalgamation of people you met.
Mm.
Yourself, I would imagine.
No.
Kelly is a social worker in a hospital.
But no, not me.
There's none of you in it.
None of me in it.
None of you in it whatsoever. I find that hard to believe.
Actually, the family member who I have put in it is, when I was writing this, my daughter was at 16 years of age.
Yes.
And I saw so much of her, but having a healthy life at home with her dad and I and her brothers, and I'm going to work every day and seeing young girls and boys her age who are not.
Yeah.
And so I have to admit that it is modelled a lot on what she was doing at that time in terms of sport and art.
So the young girl who has cancer, 16-year-old Jessie, her mates are Amy, Luke and Ryan. Her parents are Mandy and Dean, and her social worker is Kelly.
Yes.
Yeah. And we have organisations like Make-A-Wish in this country.
Yeah.
And they do, and Share a Dream, and they do amazing work for very sick children. Somebody approaches them and they fulfil their wish. It could be going to Disneyland. It could be meeting Roy Keane. He's a famous footballer.
You got it.
Information, that sort of thing, yeah. So take it from there without giving away too much.
Look, first of all, yes, let me say to Make-A-Wish Foundation worldwide, incredible. They're on the highest pedestal for what they have done. And I was part of seeing them fulfil many, many wishes, the kind of wishes you just didn't think were possible, they made possible. By the way, I have not named them in my story.
I created a fictional foundation.
Yeah. That was partly because, well, I can't just take their name. And the consideration was, well, to approach them and start bringing lawyers into it and get permission that, well, this book might never see the light of day. But still, I want to talk about them and what they do. So the Make-A-Wish Foundation, as I say, I saw them create wishes under the most incredible circumstances. Now, where my story differs slightly to what really played out all those years ago, two things. The young boy that came in that I got to know and that this patient and their family and the people on the ward and everybody got to know and befriend, he was wanting to be there. He'd come in, I'd taken him upstairs, introduced him to the patient, left him there, thinking he'd then go away and never be seen again. And that didn't happen. He was the character that I've described here. The young guy that had never known a family, grew up in the foster system, lived on the street from about 14 and spent his time during the day playing arcade games, trying to stay out of trouble. And then had got a job with, in Melbourne, Nintendo.
Uh-huh.
But Alex, who I've written here,
the fictional character in this, who
he doesn't want to be there.
No, he's instructed by his boss to come in here and do this. And what he's asked to do is, or told to do, is to create a VR experience for Jessie's family so they can, I suppose, live with her after she dies, because she's close to death. And as you say, he doesn't want to be there, and that's the story, and it's brilliantly told. And
and her dad doesn't want him there.
Yeah,
that's the other crux of it.
And you must have seen an awful lot of this, because the diagnosis and the outcomes are, you know, have improved so much.
Yes.
You would have seen it in your experience over the last 20 or 30 years. But when a young person gets a cancer diagnosis, it's like throwing a grenade into a family, isn't it?
Well, it is. And how both mum and dad react can be very, very different. And this is what we saw so much. And I have to tell you that I sent an advance copy of this to my boss of those 20 plus years for her opinion on it. And she smacked me around the head with how I'd portrayed Kelly, saying, you know, I would never let Kelly get away with that. But she said, thank you for showing the world and your readers the reality for the parents and the siblings of these young people.
Because Dean, who's Jessie's dad, he's sort of in denial, isn't he?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
What's your main role as a father? Every man will say, it's to protect my children.
I thought you were asking me specifically. And
you can answer if you like. I'm hoping yours would be the same.
No, it would, of course. But you know, when I was reading this book, and Heather, it's the worst nightmare of any parent, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
It is the worst nightmare that they're going to get that diagnosis for their child. It's just horrific. Who knows how you'd react if it visited your door?
But we saw too many Deans.
Yeah, and Dean was the dad in denial.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you can understand that. And he was desperately searching for a cure and wanting to bring Jessie to Cyprus and other places. And when he saw Alex, who was in to fulfil a wish because his daughter was dying, he saw him as
he's
a symbol.
Replacing him, isn't
yes,
he?
Yes, and a symbol of her impending death. And that's, you know, he didn't like any of that.
No.
No. But it's beautifully written. And,
thank you.
I didn't know when I started reading it, this is the odd thing, I didn't know that you'd worked as a social worker, because I read that then in the author's notes at the end, and it all made sense.
Do you think I should put those author notes in the front then?
Maybe.
I've considered that.
Yes, I tell you why, because there are a number of things that I've learnt about you which are really interesting. There are parallels between this book, your life, and the tattooist of Auschwitz.
True.
I'll explain that to you now.
Okay. You give me your version.
Yeah, okay, right. So in this book, this man comes in who doesn't know this family from Adam. He's a reluctant participant in this make-a-wish thing, for want of a better word. And then he becomes, in a very short period of time, a huge part of that family.
Yes.
So much so that he has access to the hospital with codes and all that sort of thing. And I thought to myself, that would never happen. But back in 2003, when you were introduced to Lally, who was the tattooist of Auschwitz, you became that person, didn't you?
Yeah.
In that family.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you know, that played out 3 years later when Lally had a serious stroke and was in hospital and he wasn't going to be surviving. His son contacted me and said the words that just chill me to the bone, but humble me so much, when he said, would I go and see his dad and spend time with him? He hadn't allowed any of his friends, nobody else. And he said, you have been the most important person in my dad's life since my mum died. So you alone. And he had the wisdom to see that. I didn't think I would see him, but to his credit.
That's an odd thing about human nature, isn't it?
You still get surprised.
Yeah, that stranger comes in and out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And that man was in his 80s. And he'd met all these people throughout his life. And you come in, parachute in from nowhere.
Yeah.
And you became such an important part of his life. And this happens in this book as well. It's fictional, but it happens in this book as well. And there's a lovely love story. And I cried at the end. There's twists and all that sort of thing. So what's the reaction been from your fans? Because this is the way it works now, the publishing industry, doesn't it?
Pretty much, yes.
So what have they said?
Oh, look, it's a newbie, all right. But we did, of course, get advanced readers to comment on it. Overwhelmingly supportive and loving and recommending, highly recommending only one, and I've read quite a lot that got put on social media, and a lot of them go to my publishers because they've been sent the copies through them. Brilliant, wonderful comments. One lass or lady wrote on my Insta last week, I don't think I enjoy this as much as Heather's other books. I think she should stick to writing what she knows best.
there you go.
But she said it was still a good read and she found a couple of positive things, but, you know, get back in your lane, kid.
You should put the author's note at the beginning for her in particular. Yeah.
So I wrote back to her and just said, look, thank you very much. I do appreciate you posting this and I do appreciate your words. I want to hear them, good, bad and indifferent. Mm. So I do appreciate and thank you. And I meant it.
But did you not tell her that you were a social worker in a hospital for 20 years?
I don't know. But within about seconds, she just wrote back saying, oh, my God, you read it. Yeah. I do read them.
Why do you read them, though?
Because I don't take it for granted that people have, you know, invested hours of their life in reading these stories.
Is that because it came to you late in life?
Probably, yeah. You get a bit older and not necessarily wiser, but you're much more appreciative of everything that comes your way, including the good, the bad and the ugly comments.
We're talking to Heather Morris. Her new book is The Wish, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that and the tattooist of Auschwitz after a quick commercial.
Email ray@rte.ie. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, we're talking to writer Heather Morris. You don't like to be called a novelist. You'd like to be called a storyteller. Go on, explain yourself.
I didn't know how to write. I'd never written, never thought about it. And I was talking with my brothers a couple of years ago and we were having that conversation that you can have. Yeah, what do you think Mum and Dad, one of them said, would say about what's going on with you? And we joked and sort of we all gave our two bobs worth what it was. And I went, yeah, you know, this whole writing thing, that was never for me. And one of my brothers looked and went, yeah, but you always were the family bullshit artist. You have always been telling stories. And I remember going home and saying to the hubby, do I always tell stories? And he went, yeah. Never occurred to me that I just have been doing it.
You're a natural storyteller.
Make them up if somebody won't tell me one, I'll make one up.
And your dad was a farmer, was he?
Yeah, so I grew up in dairy country in the North Island.
Yeah. And did you read a lot as a child?
We didn't have access to books, but I can tell you what I read because my dad insisted that we should have access to them. I grew up reading the Encyclopedia Britannica.
You were posh. We had the Tree of Knowledge, which is the cheap version.
Well, for me, reading about foreign cultures and lands and religion, that was amazing. I needed to travel the world. I needed to get out of the small town I was in. And they allowed me to escape.
A window to an outside world.
Yeah.
Oftentimes, New Zealand and Ireland are compared. Size, population, agricultural base, all that sort of thing. Do you see those similarities?
Yeah, who's got the better rugby team?
We've beaten you a good few times now, Flesh. Come on,
You're doing all right. absolutely, I do.
Yeah.
You travel around here and see the countryside, even if you just think about the landscape. It's similar, that emerald green.
I think you have more spectacular landscape inland, you know.
Yeah, we've got a few mountain ranges.
Do you know you have Noel Edmonds over there now? Do you know Noel Edmonds? You should check him out. He used to be a presenter on the BBC and he's now gone to New Zealand and he has a reality TV show of setting up this sort of energy park. It's very interesting.
Okay, and look, living in Australia now, I'm kind of missing that.
You're missing that. Okay, so The Tattooist of Auschwitz. And it's been made into a 6-part dramatisation and it's on Sky.
True.
And this is where this is the representation, a reconstruction, a dramatisation of you meeting Lolly for the first time. Where did I put it? There it is there.
Mr. Sokolov.
Call me Lolly.
My colleague Rosa, who plays tennis with Susan, who went to school with Gary, she said that you're looking for someone to write your life story?
Yes.
She said you were in a concentration camp in World War II.
Yes. In Poland, Auschwitz-Birkenau.
There it is. Is that how it happened?
Kind of, yeah. But I didn't know when I went there that he had been in a concentration camp. I was just meeting a man.
Aha, who had a story.
Who had a story. Yeah. But can I tell you, hearing Harvey there, he is so like Lully. His voice, he pitched it perfectly. I gave him many tapes of Lully. He studied them and I spent time with him also talking about him. And he had a voice coach to absolutely mimic him. And
this is Harvey Keitel who played Lully in the...
Yeah, and when I hear him there, I just get chills to the bone. I'm hearing Lully.
And was it somebody who knew Gary, who was Lolly's son?
It was a friend of Gary's who was also a friend of mine, but I didn't know Gary. And I was having a cup of coffee with her one day and she said, oh, look, I've got a friend whose mother's just died and his father has asked him to find somebody to tell a story to. And that person can't be Jewish. She said, you're not Jewish. Do you want to meet him? And I hadn't done anything. And I went, oh, what's the story? And she said, I don't know. And so I said, look, yeah, sure, I'll meet him. And a week later I did, not knowing who, what, when or where. But I found out that, you know, Gary had brought several other friends of his and journalists to meet his dad. But they were all Jewish. And he wasn't having a bar of it.
And why was he so hell-bent on not having a Jewish writer?
Well, as many, many Holocaust survivors have said to me, Lully was a wise man. And for him, it was very clear there could not be a Jewish person alive that wasn't affected by the Holocaust, somewhere in their background. He said, they will have their own baggage. How can they tell my story when they've got their own?
Uh-huh.
So for him, it was about, you know, you get me this person who has to hold her head in shame and acknowledge how little her knowledge of the Holocaust was.
You had no CV. You had no writing CV. You were still working as a social worker.
Oh, yeah. And continued for the next sort of, 12, 13 years.
But I tell you what you had, which is a transferable skill from social work. You listened. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. If you want to learn anything in life, my great-grandfather told me, shut up and listen.
And you listened a lot to Lully.
I listened a lot.
Yeah.
And I made sure when they were writing the miniseries that very early on, when it follows immediately after that clip you played, when Lully starts talking and he looks over, or Harvey looks over at Melanie, and he goes, you want to write this down?
Melanie played you.
Yes. Yeah. And she just says, no, I just want to listen, because that's what I did. Never wrote anything down, never recorded anything in front of him. Just listened.
And was that just intuition?
Yes. Look, it comes from, once again, also working in a hospital when you're meeting somebody for us, it was a family member of somebody who was seriously ill, accident, heart attack, whatever, that you need to make sure that they know you're listening to them, and you can't do that if you're writing down. Mm. So we wouldn't even write down their names. It's a classic case, and mental health experts use it, and it's well documented. But if you're talking to somebody and you start writing, that other person will lean over to see what you're writing.
Mm.
You record them, like you're doing with me right now, and they're going to watch every word they say.
This is live, by the way.
Yeah, yeah, I kind of worked that out. Right? There's a big sign up there that says Mike Live.
We are recording you, but there are people listening, just so you know.
Got it.
Yeah. It was so trust, nearly instant trust, was it?
No. For him, he couldn't tell a story with a beginning, a middle and end if he tried. He rambled, he waffled. He occasionally stopped speaking in English and flipped into Slovakian or some other language I didn't understand, and I just let him go. But there were times that were starting to get a little bit more frequent. He would start to tell me something and then he'd stop. And because I'm watching him, I could see that, okay, what he wanted to tell me is painful. He can't go there. He can't go there yet. So finally one day it kind of twigged on me and I went, you got any dinner? It was a Sunday afternoon. What are you having for dinner? He said, I don't know. I'll find some soup. We just had soup. I said, no, come home with me. And I took him home to meet my husband and three young adult children. And for the first time, I heard him laugh as I saw him openly flirting with my daughter, 18-year-old daughter. And he spent that evening with us and the kids told him every foible and every sort of fault that I had and even made some up.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was driving him home, he kind of looked over at me and went, "You're just an ordinary person." And I went, "Yeah, what did you think?" He said, "That you weren't." And that happened, and within a matter of about a week, and one other thing happened. Lally had two dogs, and every time I was with him, the two dogs, they were there, he threw tennis balls, they fought after them, they were part of his life, big part of his life. One, Tootsie, was the size of a small pony, and little Bam Bam was smaller than my cat. And this whole tennis ball thing, it was really interesting because they'd crash over furniture. And one day, Tootsie, the big dog, came up and had the tennis ball in her mouth, and Lully reached down to take it from her, and she growled at him and didn't release it. And he gave her a bit of clip over the ear. "Give me the ball." But Tootsie turned round and put her head on my knee and just looked at me with these big teeth and this big mouth. And I risked it. I put my hand down into her mouth and touched the tennis ball, and she released it. And I threw it over my shoulder. And that's when Lully said,
"That was a moment.
My dog is like you. I like you. I can tell my story.
You live in a movie, you do." And that was the thing. He said to you, "This is a love story as well." And was the love story between him and Geeta. They met in Auschwitz. And although the series and the book is called The Tattooist, he never referred to himself as a tattooist.
Now, he made the numbers.
He made the numbers.
Yeah, right. I made the numbers. That was probably his accent and his understanding of English.
And that's how he met Geeta.
That's how he met Geeta, that day that he stabbed those numbers into her arm, dressed in rags and a head shaven. And he could say to me, 60, 70 years later, I looked up into her eyes and I knew in that instant I could never love another. Now, this is a guy that had been telling me all about his life as a playboy in Bratislava.
Right.
Love him and leave him guy.
Good-looking guy.
Good-looking guy. That was his words, actually. I was a good-looking guy.
All right. Not as good-looking as Robert Redford, but good-looking guy.
Oh, no, please don't. That's painful, that is. But, yeah, love him and leave him guy he was. Lots of girlfriends. So what was it about this young 18-year-old girl? He saw the defiance in her eyes. He saw that, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to survive.
Yeah. So he died just after his 90th birthday.
Yeah, 3 days.
Yeah. So what do you think he'd think of all this? How many copies has the Tattooist of Auschwitz sold?
Look, I'm not sure how it breaks down. I just get given, your book.
Millions and millions.
It's sort of 19 million, right, I think, was the last sort of sum to throw my way.
What would Lully think of all this?
He would expect it. He said, of course it was going to happen. I trusted you to tell my story.
Yeah.
There would be no if, buts or maybes with him. This is going to happen. I told you to write Silke's story. Yeah, I made you promise to write that story.
That was the second book, yeah.
Yeah.
And then The Three Sisters was the...
And then, yeah, for him, it's just, yeah, of course, this was the destiny that he would have foreseen.
Right.
He was that kind of guy.
Yeah. Well, listen, I've really enjoyed our time together. Heather Morris, The Wish is the new book. Available now. Just before I let you go, so people can watch The Tattooist of Auschwitz on Sky, is there any other adaptations in the pipeline?
Being talked about, but they're nothing in development yet.
Right.
Being talked about.
Yeah. The Wish, perfect, I think, from my reading of it.
Look, thank you. Actually, there is a producer in Sydney that's got his hands on it. He likes the idea of that being a movie of the week.
Right.
So...
Yeah,
we'll see.
And how does that work, the optioning? They just approach you?
Well, with Tattooist, the publishers give it to an agent in Hollywood at CAA, and they then put it out to auction, so to speak.
All business, all business.
It's all about the money, guys.
Yes. Heather Morris, enjoy your time in Ireland. Thank you very much for coming in. That's it from us. Cormac and Sarah are on Drive Time. We are back tomorrow at 3 o'clock. Enjoy the rest of your Wednesday evening.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.